We are continuing research that Penrose won the Nobel Prize for, so it's going to be a little difficult, but worthwhile. The proof that general relativity actually implies the existence of singularities and therefore predicts its own downfall. Okay, so lecture 21, causality. We say that a space-time is causal if it does not contain closed causal, that is, time or null, time-like or null curves. Remember we said that a space-time is time-orientable if you can, in a continuous way, always assign a future and a past for each light cone. And we had this example where a space-time was, let's say, the outside of a cylinder, and you could have that the light cones would go, as you go around the cylinder, they sort of tip over and come back 180 degrees shifted. And in that case, you couldn't time orient the manifold, because what looks like the future, once you go around in a continuous way, becomes the past. So you don't have a continuous way of assigning that. And we said early on, no, we only want to work with space-times that are time-orientable. However, what can also happen is that the space-time, in spite of being time-orientable, it can also be acausal. It can violate causality, namely in the following way. Imagine, again, you have a space-time that is the outside of a cylinder, just for simplicity. There are many other circumstances as well. And imagine that the light cones are, let's say here, they're pointing up. The future light cone points up as usual. This is time, this is space. So the future light cones are all pointing up, that's fine. Here too, the future light cones are all pointing up. The whole thing is time orientable, there's no flip by 180 degrees. No, but imagine that around here, the light cones tilt, right? And they could even tilt in such a way that the lower boundary here of this light cone might be horizontal. In which case, you could actually, or light could actually travel in such a way that as it just keeps going around. It's just horizontal, 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 right? So in even though the space-time is time-orientable, you could have circumstances where you have closed light-like loops, closed light-like curves, right? And that would make things not causal, because you could go back and become your younger self again. For somehow that would be very weird. So we say that a space-time is causal if this doesn't happen, if it doesn't have any closed time-like or null curves. So you can't just travel back into the past. So obviously you could, you know, kill your grandfather or something. That would not be causal. So we say that a space-time is strongly causal if an extra condition holds. You see, it could be that the space-time is causal, but just barely. Now, a space-time is called strongly causal if, for all points of the space-time and for all neighborhoods of this point, there is a neighborhood within that neighborhood such that no causal curve intersects this sub-neighborhood more than once. This is just a mathematically accurate way of saying that, yes, you can try to do a loop, but you cannot get arbitrarily close to your starting point. You have to have a finite distance, right? Because it says that if this is your starting point, and you pick a neighborhood of it, then there is a sub-neighborhood that you can at most encounter again once. And then the next orbit you have to be away from it. And this forces you to actually move forward in time. So we say that the space-time is strongly causal if this is the case. And one can see that if it is not strongly causal, then indeed it means that there are curves which come arbitrarily close, infinitesimally close to the starting point. Of course, that is to be avoided too. So what we will require is, of course, strong causality in the spacetimes that we take seriously. This means that in this spacetime, all causal curves, meaning all curves that are either light-like or time-like, all those curves keep at least a finite distance from intersecting themselves. That still doesn't solve the problem completely, because it could be that there is a small perturbation to the metric, and this falls apart. You could have a space-time that is strongly causal, according to that definition, but you just change the metric a little bit, like a fly lands on a strawberry, and that has a gravitational impact, and suddenly it's no longer strongly causal. So that's to be avoided as well. How do we do that? Well, we consider perturbing the metric in the following way. So we take our spacetime manifold and we equip it with a new metric. That's a little bit of a perturbation with respect to the old metric. So g mu nu is the old metric, and we replace it now by a new metric g tilde mu nu, and it is the old metric minus omega mu omega nu, where omega is a time-like cotangent vector field. Why do we put the minus here, and why do we want it time-like, and so on? We will see in a moment. So we perturb the metric in this way. Now, we choose it to be time-like because that preserves the signature of the metric. So we can't change the signature of the metric if we do it like that. But the new metric obviously describes a different space-time. Something is different in here. And what is different regarding the light cones, regarding causality? What's different is that this widens all the light cones. It makes vectors that would normally not be light-like or time-like, it makes them light-like or time-like. So the light all of the old light cone is still inside the light cone, but more is now in the light cone. Why? Well, let's compare that. Let's compare the calculation of the length squared of a vector with respect to the new metric and with respect to the old metric. So let's say we want to know what is the length squared of a vector v. Now, with respect to the new metric, it evaluates in this way, because the new metric can be expressed in terms of the old metric this way. So we can express the length of a vector with respect to the new metric as the length of the vector with respect to the old metric, minus, and then we have, you know, the v contracting here, the v contracting there, so we get this. Now, whatever that number is, it's the same as that one. So this gets squared, so it's a positive number. With this minus sign, it's a negative number, which means that the length of any arbitrary vector, the length squared of any arbitrary vector, is the original length squared minus something, which makes the length shift towards the negative, right? So if v was a vector that was just barely space-like, so its length squared was a small positive number, well, with respect to the new metric g tilde, this could well be null or time-like, because we've subtracted something from its length squared. So that means that compared to previously, more vectors now qualify as time-like or light-like with respect to the metric g tilde. So we've widened all the light cones by doing this. It has become easier for vectors to be time-like or null for g tilde than it was for g. But this means that every curve that was a causal curve with respect to the metric g is definitely also a causal curve with respect to the metric g tilde, because the tangent vectors used to be time-like or light-like before, so clearly they're still time-like or light-like after, because we've just, you know, made the length squared of the tangent vectors even more negative. A negative length squared means time-like. However, more trajectories are now causal than before. right? All the trajectories that were causal trajectories, causal paths, causal curves, they are all still causal, but more trajectories are also causal. And so what we now do is we define, we say that a space-time with a metric G is called stably causal. So not just strongly causal, but stably causal. If there exists such an omega, a time-like vector field, such that even if we change from G to G tilde, it's still strongly causal. This means that the fly is allowed to land on the strawberry, right? So we can perturb. There is some perturbation that we can do to the metric, some finite perturbation that we can do to the metric. We can widen all light cones a bit, and still we have that the manifold is strongly causal. So clearly, stably causal means that it is strongly causal in particular. Now, it turns out one can prove the following theorem, namely that if a manifold is stably causal, then it means that there exists a differentiable function f such that the gradient of it is a past-directed time-like vector field. Well, if you take the minus of it, it would be future-directed, right? It doesn't matter whether it's past or future. Now, this should sound similar to what we had at the beginning of the previous lecture. The beginning of the previous lecture, we were concerned with whether a space-time manifold is time-orientable. Does it or does it not have a well-defined notion of future? Or could it be that we travel on a path and then what used to look like the future becomes the path? And we saw that this is guaranteed. Sorry, it is guaranteed that the space-time is time-orientable if there exists a time-like vector field that can be used as a reference vector field with respect to which you can define the future or the past. And now we see that stably causal also is that condition, but a little bit more. The little bit more is that it's not just any time-like vector field, it has to be a gradient vector field. It has to be the gradient of some scalar function, right? So if there it just exists a time-like vector field like that, then we know that the space-time is time-orientable. If it's actually gradient vector field, then we also know that it is stably causal. And you see, the difference in the pictures is this. In order to have it time-orientable, we only require that the light cones don't flip as you go around. But in order to have stable causality, we also want that the light cones never tilt too far. Not only are they not allowed to change orientation completely, but they're not allowed to tilt too far. And even if you open up the light cones a bit, they're still not allowed to tilt too far so that you could have closed time-like loops. And it turns out that these geometric intuitions, no flipping of the light cones on one hand, and even widened light cones are not allowed to become too close to horizontal, these two conditions can be mathematically expressed as, in the first case, the existence of a time-like vector field that you can use as a reference to define the future, a non-vanishing such vector field. And the second condition, namely that we have stable causality, boils down to saying that that vector field also has to be a gradient field. It has to derive from a scalar. OK, so now the plan is this. We assume that space-time is stably causal. So travelers cannot go on periodic or cyclic paths. And if you remember, we were looking at the detection of singularities. That's what we are after. We want to detect singularities. And then we said, we find the singularities if we find inextendable curves, inextendable geodesics. But then we said, there are three reasons really why a geodesic might not be extendable. And one of them is that it meets a hole in the manifold. That's the case we are interested in. But another possibility is that it just keeps going forever. Then it cannot be further extended because it's already going forever. And the third possibility is that the trajectory, the geodesic, just goes around in circles. That's the case we've just excluded, right? So we had three possibilities and we want to exclude two so that we are ending up with just one possibility. It's got to be singularity. Okay, so by assuming that the spacetime is stably causal, we are excluding the possibility that the geodesic just goes around in circles, and therefore there are only two possibilities for inextendable paths, inextendable geodesics. They either go on to infinity or they come from infinity, depending on whether we are looking for a future or a past singularity. Or they end in a singularity. So now let's continue to study the inextendable curves of geodesics. And by doing that, we will arrive at some key concepts, namely the key concepts of Cauchy horizon and global hyperbolicity of a spacetime. All right, let's get started with that. We considered the set of points that can be reached by matter or by light from a set S. So a set S is some set of events, and I plus of S is the set of all events. It's the future of the set of the set S. It's a causal future. It's a set of all events that can be reached by travelers or by light. These are all the points that can be affected by what goes on in S. See, there are some points that are too far away, I mean, like space-like away, so they cannot be affected what happens on S. But I plus of S is all those events that are being affected by S, or can be affected by what has been going on in S. Let me just say that again, because the next definition is a subtle twist on this. So I plus of S is the set of all points that can be affected, or that may have been affected by what has been going on in S, because signals can travel from S to I plus. Now, let's consider the set of points that can only be reached by S. Right? So the points in I plus of S can be affected by what went on S, but they can also be affected by events elsewhere. But now let's consider the set of points that are only affected by what happened on S. Why is that an interesting set of points? Well, whatever happens at these points can be predicted knowing the initial conditions on S. Because what happens at these points is only influenced by what happened on S. So let's consider the set of points that can only be reached from S. Here's the definition. Let's say S is a set of events in the space-time. And let's assume that it is a closed achronal set. Achronal, let me remind you, it means that there is no time-like trajectory, achronal, right? So no time-like trajectory between any two points of that set. So it could be, for example, a space-like hypersurface. It doesn't have to be. It could also be light-like, because between any two events on the light cone, any two events that a beam of light goes through, you can't have a time-like trajectory between them, because you can't be that far. So S could be having space-like separate events, but it could also have light-like separated events. Achronal means you just can't travel with matter in between them. So then, we define the future domain of dependence of S. So we define the set of all those events that completely depend on S and only S. Right? So the future domain of dependence of S is defined then, first of all, it's called D plus of S instead of I plus of S. it's d plus of s, and it's the set of all events in the manifold for which it is true that every past inextendable causal curve, not just geodesics, but any curve, every past inextendable causal curve through the point P intersects our set S here. Now, let's say we have here a hole in the manifold. Now, let's say we consider this point. The claim is that, you know, d plus of s is this area here, right? But why is it this area? Why is this point not included? Let's first pick a point, let's say here. And then we ask, does it qualify to be in d plus of s? Well, if this point is in d plus of s, we must have, because that's the prescription here, that every past inextendable curve that starts at p must end up on s. And clearly it has to, right? Because the backward light cone of that point goes by 45 degrees. And no matter what path you go within that light cone, right, it has to be a causal curve. So it has, you have to stay within the past light cone or on the light cone, right? You will end up on S. So therefore, every point in here, whatever happens there, is completely predicted by initial conditions given here. OK, so all these points here are clearly in the future domain of dependence of S, because if you just draw the backwards light cone, it hits complete, it's completely hitting, all of it hits somewhere S. On the other hand, let's choose this point Q over here. Well, sure, there is a dependence on what happens here, but there's a set of past inextendable smooth curves which do not intersect S. Namely, for example, a curve that goes from here and happens to end up where the singularity is. It's a curve, all right, but you won't be able to extend it there, right? Because you hit the hole on the manifold. And that's true for all the points in here, for all of those. Because within their backward light cone, you can write down past inextendable curves which hit that singularity. So therefore, this thing is sort of throwing shade here. So the future domain of dependence has this dent because there is a singularity here. All of these points are having all of their backwards trajectory tracing back to an origin here. The points over there don't. And of course, if you consider a point over here, it's clear that not all of its past inextendable curves hit S. Because some will, right? Those that go like this will hit S. But if you're there, well, how about a past inextendable curve that goes like that? It will just go on forever, never meeting S. Similarly, we can define the past domain of dependence of S, which is the set of all those points which can only affect S. So d minus of S is the set of all those events in the manifold, in the space-time, which is such that every future inextendable causal curve that starts at P must intersect S. So for example, if you have a point down here, then a future inextendable curve will go like this, or like that, or like that, and it will intersect S. It will go on and on and so on, but it will intersect S. Of course, there will be future inextendable curves that hit the singularity, but that's fine. They still hit S first. Right? So the question is, what is the past domain of dependence of S? And that's all those events that, for which all of their impact, all of what they can affect, all these effects will go through S. And then we put the future and past domain of dependence together. And we call that the total or full domain of dependence of S. And that's just a union of the future domain of dependence, this one, and the past domain of dependence, which would be just this. Right? That's the past domain of dependence here. And if you put them together, then that's the full domain of dependence of S, just a union. Now, the next definition is a very important one. And that's the question, how far do initial conditions set on a surface, how far does their impact reach? How far do they have full predictive power or postdictive power, right? So if you know the initial conditions on such a set of events S, then you have full predictive power here, right? But not past a singularity. So you also have full postdictive power about what happened in the past domain of dependence, because stuff over here doesn't bother you there. You can postdict what's in there. You can simply run the equations of motion backwards in time within that backward domain of dependence. And so then you can ask, well, what is the boundary of how far the full predictive or postdictive power of that S reaches? And what is that? Well, it's called the, when it comes to defining it for the future, so how far into the future is the full, is the predictive power from initial conditions knowledge on S, how far in the future it is a full predictive power, that's what we call the future Cauchy horizon of S. And it's called H plus of S, because it's about the future. And we define it in the following way. We say that H plus of S, the future Cauchy horizon of this S, is the closure of the future domain of dependence. So we take this domain of dependence and then we close that. So, you know, if there's a boundary, we include that. But of course, that's a hole in the manifold. That's never included in a closure because it's literally not a point in the manifold, so we can't add it. So we take the closure, and then what we do is we take the future domain of dependence. So that's all of that, right? All of this, D plus, is all of this. And then we consider its chronological past, which means you take that and you subtract everything that is time-like from there backwards, which is simply to say we hollow it out, right? So what we do is we take D plus, we close it, right? We take the closure of that. And then we hollow it out by taking the D plus and take all of its past away. We will find a simpler description of it in a moment. So for example, what we have is that we have to calculate D plus the closure of it. This will be all of this, including the boundaries there, right? And that's not trivial because, you see, you might think, why do we have to even close this? Isn't this closed anyway? It's not, right? It's not because you might say, well, isn't this included, for example, that line of events on the boundary, isn't that included? It is actually included, right? We don't have to close that. It's included because you have light rays that go from there. Right, future domain of dependence that includes not only the light, not only the time lag, but also light lag. So this is included, that's included. Not those two though, right? Because you can't send a light ray from here that travels that, right? You could send it from here there, but then it would get stuck. And then the light cannot continue like that, right? And you can send from here a light ray this way, but it gets stuck. So that's not included. So that's why we close the D plus of S to have all of these guys included there. You see, you can go, of course, arbitrarily close there with light rays like that. But you can't go on it. So we close that. And then we take the D plus of S, which is the whole thing, without its closure, right? It's just this whole thing. And then we take its chronological past, right? And there we are careful by taking the chronological past, is we are not actually taking that away, right? By taking only the stuff that can travel time-like, not light-like. Okay, so then what we obtain is that this plus that plus this plus that, that's the future Cauchy horizon of S. The Cauchy horizon, right? Don't mix this up later with Cauchy surface. This is the Cauchy horizon. It's the boundary of what is completely determined by initial conditions that you pose on S. Now, similarly, you can define the past Cauchy horizon of S, which is defined the same way by just flipping the pluses to minuses. And the minuses to, and the minus to plus. So this is the boundary of the set of events that can only affect S, right? Where all future time-like or light-like curves pass through S. That's the boundary of that. For example, if this is the past domain of dependence because there's no singularity in here, then it would be just that. Those two lines. Those two lines would be the past Cauchy horizon of S. So this is the boundary of what's completely predictable from S in the future. And that is the boundary, what is completely post-dictable from the past, from S to the past. And then the full Cauchy horizon of S is the union of both of them. This, 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 and that in this case. And then the proposition is that this full Cauchy horizon of S is indeed just the boundary of the domain of dependence. It's just, you know, here we build it up in a more pedestrian way. And of course, in principle, you know, you would have to go into this and check it out exactly whether this is really the case. But I think the intuition already shows that, that this is the case. I should tell you also that the notation, unfortunately, is not completely consistent in the literature, which is really unfortunate because it's a zoo of terminology. And if you look at the book by Hawking and Ellis and the works by Hawking, Ellis, and Geroch and others, then they're using a different notation to this. But I think it's best explained in the textbook by Wald, and so I adopted that notation. So if you want to read up more on that, Wald is an easy, comparatively an easy read to other books. But the definitions by others are equivalent. So now we define the key concept of a Cauchy surface. And the Cauchy horizon is how far can you predict, how far can you post-dict given an achronal set S. Now, the definition is, the definition of a Cauchy surface is this, a closed achronal set S, and remember achronal means no two events can be traveled in between. So there might be light that you can send in between them, but no traveler could travel between elements of the set S. So what this means is such an achronal set, remember, could be space-like, could also be light-like. So a closed achronal set S is called a Cauchy surface if its Cauchy horizon vanishes, if it doesn't have a Cauchy horizon, which means it sounds terrible. What? It doesn't have a, you can't predict anything? No, it means the opposite. If it doesn't have a Cauchy horizon, it means, well, it never ends. You can predict everything forever, and you can post-dict everything forever in the past. Right? So there's no boundary to how much you can predict, how much you can post-dict. So a closed achronal set S is called a Cauchy surface if its full Cauchy horizon vanishes. That is to say, if the full Cauchy horizon, H of S, is the empty set, so the zero with the bar through it would be the empty set, I grew up writing the empty set differently, namely simply curly bracket open, curly bracket closed, nothing in it. But I don't know, in this community, they like to write the empty set as a zero with a slash through it. And then that's the same as the boundary of the total domain of dependence. And it's the same as saying that the domain of dependence of S is the entire manifold itself. And clearly, if you have an infinite size space-time, then your S also will have to be infinite in size. It can't just end here, because otherwise, how could you predict what's over there or there, right? So in practice, what that means is, like in our space-time, it means that you need a space-like hypersurface that is an entire slice through all of the universe. It doesn't have to be space-like. You could also have it space-like for a while and then, for example, turn light-like. That comes up sometimes too. Or you could have the whole thing light-like. You can also, I mean, it's not very practical in practice that you set initial conditions on a light cone or on a light sheet. But in principle, you might, I mean, mathematically, this can be possible. Okay, so we say that a corner set is a Cauchy surface if the domain of dependence of that surface is the entire manifold. So Cauchy surfaces are important. And this is because if the initial conditions on a Cauchy surface are known, then everything on the manifold can be predicted and retrodicted or postdicted. And you might wonder, well, okay, we always want that, right? well, nowadays, anti-de Sitter space is quite popular. Anti-de Sitter space doesn't have Cauchy surfaces. So it's non-trivial. One has to look out for that. But Friedman, Robertson, Walker, Lemaître spacetimes do. Now, since a Cauchy surface is achronal, so space-like or light-like or mixed, then it can be viewed as an instant in time. Clearly, if it's space-like, clearly that's an instant in time. If it's light-like, well, remember that for light, no time passes. But it's probably easiest visualized as a space-like hypersurface, as an instant in time. And the term surface, in conjunction with Cauchy, so Cauchy surface, or Cauchy hypersurface, is motivated by this theorem, which says that every Cauchy surface in a 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time, every such Cauchy surface, capital sigma, is a 3-dimensional submanifold of the space-time. Now, if the space-time does possess a Cauchy surface, then it is what is called globally hyperbolic. If it possesses a Cauchy surface, then it possesses a lot of Cauchy surfaces. Now, if a space-time possesses a Cauchy surface, then it's called globally hyperbolic. And hyperbolic, that term comes from the theory of partial differential equations, where you study what set of initial conditions is sufficient to solve the partial differential equation uniquely. So we will need this notion of the existence of a Cauchy surface, or equivalently, the notion of global hyperbolicity of the space-time. We will need that later for cosmological singularity theorem, where we will assume that the space-time has this property. It turns out that, strictly speaking, these statements are relative to the set of differential equations, partial differential equations that we are considering. This is all true for electromagnetism, for the Klein-Gordon theory, for the Dirac theory, and so on. But it turns out that if you look at higher derivative theories, or fields with spin higher than 2, including 2, there's really a spin higher than 1, actually, you can't have Cauchy surfaces in general. And not if the wave equations are linear. So linear wave equations, it's difficult to specify Cauchy surfaces for linear wave equations of higher spin or of higher derivatives in a consistent way on a generic curved space-time. That's a major obstacle, and a priori it would seem like we have a contradiction right away. I mean, one hand, yes, all the standard model fields have only up to second derivatives and only spin up to one. Right? So that's consistent with that. So we don't have to explain anything there because, yes, all of this holds true for standard model fields that we know about. And it's indicative of something going on behind the scenes, some principle of physics that we haven't quite discovered yet. Because remember that the standard model is full of different particle species that come with their different fields. And for some reason, they all have spin one or less. They all have only derivatives up to two at most. And now we see, well, there would actually be a problem with causality if it was otherwise, right? And so it could be that somehow there's a mechanism in which gravity forces that there is no spin higher than one and that there are no derivatives higher than two. Nobody knows quite what that mechanism is, but it would be great because we want to explain the standard model of particle physics. And whatever is forcing the spin to be at most one and the derivatives at most two maybe also forces the other structures of the standard model of particle physics. Maybe that's what forces the masses too, and the coupling constants, and why we have U1, SU2, SU3 gauge symmetries. Not clear, but clearly there is a connection here between what gravity requires and the standard model delivers. We just don't know what the mechanism is. We know it's consistent, but how is the consistency enforced? We don't know that yet. But then, as I mentioned just a minute ago, something looks odd, which is that gravity spin too. Gravity spin too. So how come the gravitational initial value problem seems to be well defined? And the reason is that gravity is nonlinear. What I said earlier applies to linear wave equations that have linear superposition. The sum of two solutions is the solution again. Not so with the Einstein equation. If you have one metric that solves the Einstein equation and another metric that solves the Einstein equation, good luck thinking that the sum of the two metrics solves the Einstein. No, it doesn't, right? And it doesn't work with the connection either. It's a nonlinear theory, and that's the way out here. So somehow, gravity imposes these constraints on what the fields are, but itself evades the constraint by being nonlinear and then allowing itself to have spin too. There is, in fact, a whole research field that investigates what alternatives to gravity would be possible in the sense of having a well-defined Cauchy problem and therefore having a well-defined notion of causality in the various numbers of space-time dimensions. And we don't have time to go into the details of that, but 3+1 dimensions is a critical case in there. Again, an indication that something is going on, right, where causality is enforced, and just to enforce causality seems to be forcing gravity and the standard model of particle physics to not go too crazy, right? But the mechanism nobody knows. We just know it's all consistent, of course it has to, but if we are asking why does gravity look the way it does, and why does the standard model look the way it does, whatever enforces the consistency between the two might also force why gravity looks the way it does and the standard model does. Big mystery, though. And we need fresh ideas there. Okay, so as we just said, Cauchy surfaces are important because if the conditions on the Cauchy surface are known, then everything on the manifold can be predicted and postdicted. And by conditions on the Cauchy surface, I mean not just the amplitudes, but you might also require to know the derivatives. Now, since the Cauchy surface, by that theorem that we had earlier, is achronal, it can be viewed as an instant in time. But remember, it could also be light-like, not necessarily space-like. and it's always a three-dimensional thing. Okay, and then we said that if there is a Cauchy surface, that is to say, if all of the manifold can be postdicted, all that happens in spacetime can be postdicted and can be predicted, then we call it globally hyperbolic. Now, there's an important proposition, namely, if the spacetime is globally or hyperbolic, then there exists a global time function f. Something like a clock, such that every surface of constant f value is a Cauchy surface. And we can use that function then to show that the spacetime is therefore also stably and therefore also strongly causal. That global time function is, of course, not unique. The point is we have at least one. And so it's not like there is a unique time function. No, it just means that there are time functions you can use. There are functions you can use that are monotonically growing, and you can use them to define equal time. And there are many of them. OK, but let's remember what we are really after. I mean, this is all good and fine to know about this. Definitions of Cauchy surface and global hyperbolicity. But what we are really after at the moment is singularities, singularity proof of the necessity of there being singularities. So here the plan is to study in extendable geodesics in order to detect singularities. But how can we identify these geodesics that are inextendable because they have a singularity in the manifold? There could also be trivial cases where the manifold is ending, but it could be extended. So we say that a space-time is inextendable. And remember, this is not a path. This is a space-time. We say that a space-time is inextendable if it is not isometric to a proper subset of another space-time. Right? So imagine you just punch a hole into a manifold for no good reason, right? Then yes, you could view this as a singularity, but it's not a forced one. It's one that we humans imposed, right? And it would be trapped. It would be detected by this criterion. Because we could simply say, oh, well, what about the space-time manifold that didn't have this hole punched out of it, right? Clearly, the one that we are now left with the hole is simply a proper subset of this other space-time. So clearly, we detect, oh yeah, that was just a hole punched out of it. And so it is extendable. But not, of course, if, for example, the curvature in some way diverges. And that's why there's a hole in the manifold. Then we cannot simply say, OK, but let's just define the manifold even at that point and declare the curvature to be infinite. We can't do that. We can't have infinite curvature on a point. So that would actually be detected. So now, in the future, we will always assume that the space-time is inextendable. So we take out those trivial cases where we could just fill in. You may remember cases like that, where it was not with manifolds, but with functions. Take, for example, the function sine of x divided by x. That function isn't defined at x equal to 0. Right? Because you would have to divide by 0. But the limit for x going to 0 from left and right is very well defined. It's 1. And so you can remove that singularity there, because there really isn't a singularity. We just have a hole there. Right? And then you define a new function, the so-called sinc function, which is sine x over x. And at the point x equal to 0, you just fill in that its amplitude is declared to be 1, because that's the limit from left and right. And that function is a very well-defined function. It's even an entire function. You can Taylor expand it with an infinite radius of convergence, even around 0. So with manifolds, the same thing. Sometimes you just have, you know, unnecessarily holes punched into it. You may wonder, well, where does this ever come up? I mean, which crazy physicist would just declare to take points out of the manifold willy-nilly, just like that? Punch holes into it. Well, physicists did that for a long time. Namely, when they discovered the Schwarzschild solution, of the Einstein equations, they noticed that the metric blew up at what we now call the horizon. Right? The metric blows up, ill-defined. Or is it? You see, they thought, oh, this is the end of the validity of our theory. And so they actually took out the horizon and everything that's in it. They didn't know it's a horizon. They just thought it's a weird solution and it's only good up until it blows up. Schwarzschild never knew any better than that. But later it was discovered that if you just change coordinate system, then the metric tensor doesn't blow up there anymore. It's a coordinate singularity. You've just made an unlucky choice of coordinates. With an unlucky choice of coordinates, you can make the metric blow up anywhere you want. Because you can choose really crazy coordinate system, right? So that happens. So it can happen that you accidentally punch holes into the manifold where it's not necessary. We have to be careful there. Okay, so then we define that a geodesic, which is inextendable, but possesses a finite range of its affine parameter, is called an incomplete geodesic. These are the guys we're interested in. Why is that? You see, a geodesic which is inextendable might be inextendable because, remember, there's only one alternative to running into a singularity. It's a geodesic that just keeps running forever, right? But we want, that cannot be extended. It's already running forever, right? But we want the ones that are inextendable because they run into a singularity, right? And so now we say that a geodesic which is inextendable but possesses a finite range of its affine parameter, that's an incomplete geodesic. This is not a geodesic that runs forever because it has only a finite range of its parameter. We say affine parameter as a terminology for what could be the time, right? But light, for example, cannot be parameterized by proper time because for light, no proper time passes. So it's just some parameter, and this is collected by these possibilities that the parameter of the geodesic is time or it's some other parameter. It's always just called the affine parameter. Okay, so what we are after is the incomplete geodesics. The geodesics that cannot be extended, but they have only a finite range of their parameter. So this excludes those inextendable geodesics which keep going to infinity. So now, we have really purified the situation here. We are looking at the incomplete geodesics now. That we want to prove that they exist. If we find incomplete geodesics, this tells us there is a singularity. So the definition is, we say that a spacetime possesses a singularity if it possesses an incomplete geodesic. And the type of singularity is denoted by the type of incomplete geodesic. It could be a space-like, time-like, light-like geodesic, and correspondingly, we give the name to the singularity. So we distinguish singularities of null, space-like, or time-like type. The space-like ones are, of course, weird, right? Because you couldn't travel there. Neither could light travel there, right? It's a space-like geodesic. Okay, so now when going along an incomplete geodesic towards a singularity, one of three things, or two or three of three things can happen. Namely, a scalar that is constructed from the Riemann curvature tensor, such as the Ricci scalar, but also something like the square of the Ricci tensor, which is not the same as the Ricci scalar, right? Because the Ricci scalar is obtained by contracting the Ricci tensor with the metric. But you can also contract it with itself, and so on. So if a scalar constructed from the Riemann curvature tensor diverges, then we say we have a scalar curvature singularity. And one might think that this is the only singularity type that could occur. Well, yes, something in terms of the curvature diverges. Now, you may wonder, why are there different possibilities? Well, remember that curvature in high dimensions can be in various forms. You could have curvature between, you know, the x and the y direction, or curvature between the y and the time direction, and so on. There are many different possibilities for what kind of curvature you could have, and mixtures between all of those. And if you want to capture that in a scalar way, then you have to form scalars. So R is some sum of all possible curvatures in all directions. Or is it? Does it even contain all of them? Not necessarily, right? Because these guys contain only Ricci curvature, not Weyl curvature. But you could imagine, for example, sources of Weyl curvature, gravitational waves, you know, irradiating a point. And then maybe the whole thing, you know, it's just gravitational waves. Could lead to a singularity. I don't know of any concrete example of that, but should be possible. Okay, so we have a scalar curvature singularity in this case. But it could also be that in a parallel transported tetrad frame, where each of the components of the curvature tensor are no longer coordinate system dependent, right? Because we've held the frame fixed. Then each of the components becomes a scalar itself. Because in the scalar, in the sense that it doesn't change with change of coordinate system, because we've chosen a frame. It could be that any one of these scalars or its covariant derivatives diverge. And that's a possibility too. And that captures also the Weyl curvature. And we say that this is a parallel propagated curvature singularity in this case. It could also be none of the above. It could also be something weird, namely a conical singularity, which is what you would obtain if you take, for example, a piece of paper, like A4 or letter-sized paper, and then you cut out something in the shape of a slice of pizza. Okay? And then you take the two surfaces, the two lines where you cut it, and you put the paper together and glue it together with sellotape or something, right? Now the paper will have to give some way. It can no longer be flat. It now has to look like an ice cream cone, right? Because you've cut out a triangle shape, and then you glue the two cut lines together, then the whole thing becomes an ice cream cone. And then at the tip of the cone, that's where you would have your singularity then.
But the manifold isn't differentiable at that point, right? So doesn't that...
Yeah, it's not a point of the manifold.
Oh.
Remember?
Okay.
It's a singularity.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not a singularity where the curvature would diverge. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so then let's get back to the original Nobel Prize winning question here. In concrete solutions that we know, such as Friedmann-Lemaître spacetimes or the Schwarzschild spacetime, in concrete solutions, we know that curvature singularities are present. We can calculate what the curvature scalar is. We can calculate all these terms in the curvature tensor, and we can check, do they get divergent or not? And we find that, yes, they contain singularities. The Schwarzschild spacetime does. And so does, for example, a Friedmann-Lemaître model that's radiation dominated. It has a starting time, and you can follow things back in time towards the starting time. Really, you have a curvature singularity. However, and that's the main problem, these spacetimes are highly symmetric. And that's, as we said, it's just like having a spinning top that's perfectly symmetric. And then let's say you make it thinner and thinner, you know, like the ice skater, make the spinning top thinner and thinner. Then it would start to spin faster and faster. And you could imagine that, yes, as I make it thinner and thinner, it will spin faster and faster. But imagine it has a little bit of an asymmetry. Can you imagine how this thing going, you know, with a monkey-like velocity, it goes around really fast. At some point, you know, if there is an unbalance in this, things might start to fly apart somehow, right? And here we're saying, no, none of this is happening. We have perfect symmetry in a space-time Robertson-Walker-Lemaître space-time, or in a black hole Schwarzschild space-time too, perfect symmetry. So with perfect symmetry, yes, everything is fine. But if it's not symmetric, if it's a real solution, do we really still get a singularity? And for example, if you look at a spherically symmetric dust shell, that you let in for. So you have a sphere of dust. And then gravitationally, it will implode. Now, you can calculate that with Newton gravity and with Einstein gravity. And in Newton gravity, we can use what is called catastrophe theory. Maybe you have heard about this. Catastrophe theory is when you have processes such as that, where you have this this spherical shell of dust, and it collapses into itself, and then you ask what is happening if it's not symmetric. Catastrophe theory also explains, for example, the patterns of light at the bottom of swimming pools. You see, you have a wave surface that's a little bit wavy, and then you have the sunlight. The light that comes from the sun comes in pretty much plain waves because it's so far away, like 10 light minutes away. The light arrives in plain waves, and then it's diffracted by the surface of the water that's not quite flat. And then at the bottom of the swimming pool, you get these bright lines, right? These are the catastrophes where you have this focusing, an accidental focusing. So there's a whole theory that studies these accidental focusings and what dimension they have and what shape they have and all of that. And Newton gravity, together with catastrophe theory, predicts an infinite mass density to occur if the infall is perfectly symmetric, but not if it's not perfectly symmetric. So you wouldn't have an infinite mass density according to Newton there. But in Einstein gravity, it's different. In Einstein gravity, we can use singularity theorems that we will talk about in a moment, and then we can predict that there will be a black hole singularity. So if there's enough dust and it collapses enough, then it will disappear behind a horizon and it will actually crush itself into a singularity. Even if there is some non-symmetry, some angular momentum, and so on. Depends, of course, on how much angular momentum there is. If there's too much, then it might just turn into a disk that never forms a black hole. But we will need some assumptions there, some further assumptions, such as the dominant or strong energy condition. Okay, so this is what our endeavor is at the moment. We want to either predict the occurrence of a singularity from non-symmetric initial conditions, or post-dict a Big Bang singularity from how the universe looks now. And so the whole point of these famous singularity theorems is that the prediction of singularities or post-diction of singularities is actually robust, unlike in Newtonian gravity. Which is interesting also from the perspective that ultimately what we want is a theory of quantum gravity. And quantum gravity is in part motivated by the idea that quantum theory might resolve or regulate those singularities. So if, for example, in the interior of a black hole, everything gets crushed into a point, we have to ask, what point? You know, what's the point anyway? Do we really assume that the Planck length can be, that we can go beyond the Planck length? You see, that's a challenge for quantum gravity. Because quantum gravity is meant to resolve the singularities, but classically singularities are unavoidable. So let's say you have a path integral over possible space-times evolution and possible matter evolutions. Well, a lot of them, in the path integral, you're path integrating over classical solutions, right? And so these classical solutions would all be subject to this, and then they would all have singularities. But of course, in a path integral, you're not only summing over all possible solutions to the classical equations, you're summing over all possible classical configurations, whether or not they obey the solutions. And the actual, you sum over them whether or not they are obeying the classical equations of motion. The classical equations of motion solutions have the most contribution because of the stationary phase approximation. But there are quantum fluctuations around it. So the question is whether these quantum fluctuations around the classical solutions are sufficient to actually remove singularities. Nobody quite knows how to do this. Okay, so what's the strategy for singularity theorems? We will focus our attention on singularities that can be identified, as we just said, by the existence of incomplete, inextendable, time-like or null geodesics. Right? We are looking for incomplete, inextendable geodesics. Inextendable means, yes, we have a chance that it's a singularity. Incomplete means it's not one of those trajectories where it just goes on forever, because we are requiring that the parameter runs only a finite amount. And we will look for time-like or null geodesics that run into singularities, because it's just hard to imagine what a space-like detected singularity would be, right? Because you can't travel there. Light cannot and matter cannot. But mathematically, it's possible that there are such. So these are the important ones for us, because these are the singularities that could be in our future. If we travel the universe with sophisticated equipment, we might find ourselves encountering one of those singularities that are detectable by inextendable time-like or inextendable null geodesics, right? And the inextendability sounds like a mathematical term that, yeah, it's defined somehow, but you know what it means? It means we get killed there, right? Inextendable means that's the end. As far as we're concerned, that's the end of the universe, right? Okay, so better not travel into black holes. So other singularities, as I said, may well exist. So ones that you reach by space-like geodesics, but we won't bother with them here. Now, so the basic idea is, just to remind you of what we've been building up to, singularities can be in the way of geodesics. And the presence of singularities therefore interferes with the property of geodesics that they are extremal length curves. Now, let's briefly review what it means that we have a geodesic, that something is traveling on a geodesic, because there's something a little bit counterintuitive about it. If we want to extremize curve length in order to get a geodesic equation, we solve an Euler Lagrange equation, right, as usual. And a geodesic equation is then a differential equation. You probably still remember how it looks with the gamma, with the Christoffel symbol, and so on. So this means that at least locally, geodesics are always paths of extremal length. And so, for example, a space-like geodesic is always a curve of shortest proper distance, as it should be, right? Like you have a potato, and then you want to know what's the shortest path between two places on the potato, then, well, that's a geodesic, by definition, not the geodesic. However, did you know that time-like geodesics, the geodesics that, for example, a tennis ball will travel, they are not trajectories of minimum proper time. They are trajectories of maximum proper time. Why would that be? Why are geodesics that matter travels? How can we intuitively understand that they are of maximum proper time? Well, you see, imagine you have two events. I mean, it's always, remember that when we are talking about these geodesics, these are geodesics between two events, not two places on a potato, but two events. So a place and a time, and a place and a time. And now, there are many paths that you can travel between a place. Let's say this is a space-time event, and that's a space-time event. And you have some sort of rocket, and you could start here at that time, and you have to land there at some other specific time. And we are asking, if you travel some trajectory with your rocket, something like this, you need a certain amount of proper time to travel there, right? But you could also have your rocket go ballistically, But remember, this is not space. This is space and time here, right? Okay, so you could also go ballistically. And the point is that ballistically, it's the maximum proper time that the astronaut is traveling on this trajectory. Why would that be? Well, it's because if the astronaut does this, the engines will be screaming because there's a lot of speed and acceleration going on. But the point is speed is going on, which means the astronaut will travel faster in order to arrive at the destination. The astronaut will have to travel faster because he has to make it in time. There's a fixed arrival time, right? So he's traveling a larger distance at the same time. So being faster means clock runs slower, right? So any other path than the ballistic one, the geodesic one, takes actually more less time. And that's why these geodesics are of maximal proper time. And then, of course, this is for Minkowski space. If you do this now in the presence of gravity, you find that the actual curve, you know, is the interplay of two effects. Time runs slower if you're fast, but time also runs slower if you're close to a mass like the Earth, right? And so in order to do the maximum time, you don't want to be too close to the Earth. You don't want to go too far away. The actual maximum time trip is the trajectory of a cannonball. Right? Any closer, any lower, it would be slowing down its inner clock because it's too close to Earth. Any higher, and its trip is too long and therefore too fast, and therefore it slows down because of time dilation. And so that's a compromise that gravity does for trajectories. Anyway, so there always exist curves of maximal length between two events, even in generic space times. And now, so that's something that we will have to prove. If you remember, this is the strategy, right? Okay, so our strategy for singularity theorems: A, we will focus on identifying singularities through the existence of incomplete, inextendable, time-like geodesics. That's point A. And then the basic idea is that we identify the geodesics we identify the singularities by the property of geodesics that they are paths of extremal length. And if there's a singularity in the way, then you can't go ballistic through that singularity. That's what we will detect there. And then we noticed that extremal length for a time-like geodesic actually means maximum time rather than minimum time. And then we will prove that even in generic space-times, there always exist curves of maximal length between two events. And what assumptions will we need to make? Well, we will need, for example, the assumption that space-time is globally hyperbolic. And good thing that we defined what that means. And then E, further, we assume that matter obeys suitable so-called energy conditions. Remember, these are conditions on the energy momentum tensor. We had the weak energy condition, which said that T naught naught has to be positive, right? So the energy density has to always be positive. And then we also had the dominant energy condition, which tells us that the pressure cannot be more than the energy density. But we will need a special energy condition, a so-called strong energy condition here. And that we will use to prove that geodesics will meet a divergence of a certain quantity called the expansion in a finite proper time. But that should not be clear at this moment because I'm using terminology that I haven't introduced this, namely so-called expansion. The point is, it's a physically measurable quantity that diverges. And that indicates then the end of the extendability of a geodesic in finite proper time. And so these extremal length curves cannot be geodesics with an eigentime larger than a certain finite amount, either into the past or the future, depending on whether we're dealing with black holes or with cosmologies. And therefore, we can then conclude that there are incomplete, inextendable geodesics, and therefore that we have singularities either in the past or in the future, as the case may be. And today we won't be able to prove the singularity theorem. We will do that next time. But let me tell you how it looks already, what the complete singularity theorem is. So the singularity theorem says, or a singularity theorem that we will cover, says the following. Assume that our space-time is globally hyperbolic. So that means, in principle, future and past are pre- and post-dictable. And let's assume that the energy-momentum tensor of matter obeys the strong energy condition, which is a plausible condition, but I will tell you later what the weak points in this are. So the so-called strong energy condition is this condition here. It says that T mu nu minus 1/2 and then the trace of the energy-momentum tensor G mu nu contracted with time-like vectors psi is larger or equal to zero. There is no direct interpretation that I know of anyway, and I've really looked for it, for what the strong energy condition means. What does it mean for the energy density and the pressure, and why would we make that assumption? As we will later see, the origin of that condition is that this is really the Ricci tensor here, right? And 3 plus 1 dimensions, that's the Ricci tensor here. And so this is actually a condition on the Ricci tensor. And it says something about, it's an assumption about the curvature. It's an assumption about the curvature that it cannot go too crazy. And if we make that assumption, and we can convince ourselves that it's actually a plausible assumption, well, then there exists a twice continuously differentiable space-like Cauchy surface sigma on which the trace of the extrinsic curvature, which we will define later, is bounded from above by a negative constant c. So this extrinsic curvature is bounded from above by some constant c for all events in this Cauchy surface. And then we can prove that no past-directed time-like curve, past-directed, we are post-dicting here, we are post-dicting the existence of a cosmological singularity, then no past-directed time-like curve from a space-like hypersurface sigma can have an eigentime, that is to say, a proper length larger than 3 over c. The point being that no geodesic has anybody traveling on it for longer than this, which means this geodesic started at some point in the past, at some finite point in the past. And all geodesics must have started at most this far away in time. So that tells us that we don't need to solve the Einstein equation. All we need to check is that the space-time is, what we have to assume is that the space-time is globally hyperbolic, that the strong energy condition is obeyed. And then we can conclude technical stuff, we can conclude that there are incomplete, inextendable, time-like geodesics towards the past, which then indicates that there is a singularity. This stuff is not extendable. This is the beginning of everything. So that proves that there is a cosmological singularity in the finite past. Now, that's not what Penrose got the Nobel Prize for. He got it for black holes. And why? I mean, he proved a very similar thing for black holes. But why would he get a Nobel Prize for black holes but not for cosmology? And the reason is that in cosmology, we're not so sure there was a singularity. We don't really know, right? Because there are escape ways. The strong energy condition may not be obeyed. The universe might be collapsing and re-expanding, and it might have been a finite size in the middle. For example, Niyayesh and his wife, Hassal, are working on these things, on these bouncing cosmologies. Also, we really don't know much about the beginning of the universe. And if we extrapolate into the far past, at some point, we have to reach the regime of quantum gravity, and we don't know to what extent any of this still holds then. So it's not it's not experimentally confirmed that there was really a singularity, a Big Bang singularity. And remember that not even classically, not even all of the Friedman, Robertson, Walker, Lemaître spacetimes have a singularity at the beginning. Like, for example, De Sitter space doesn't have that. You know, the universe just has always been expanding, will always be expanding. There is just no, there is no initial singularity, and you don't have that strong energy condition fulfilled here if you have just a cosmological constant. But black holes, we're pretty sure, exist, right? And he predicted, and Hawking probably would have gotten a Nobel Prize too for this, and he predicted that black holes have to form, that black holes are not just spinning themselves out of becoming a black hole. I mean, that stars that are collapsing, heavy enough stars that are collapsing, cannot spin themselves out of becoming a black hole. So that's what they got the prize for, because we are pretty sure that there are black holes. Okay, so next time we actually prove this, and then we'll move on.